No, there we are. Our God is indeed an awesome God, and I want to tell you about an experience we had this past Yom Teruah, Rosh Hashanah, whatever you wish to call it. How many of you heard about shofars around the world? Okay, shofars around the world was inaugurated by some people we know out in Grants Pass, Oregon, Ken and Dina Wells. And it happened that Ken and his son were used in the practice. He was making shofars, I guess. And he was in the practice of, they were welcome Shabbat. They'd go out Friday at near sunset, and he and his son would blow shofars. And one day, they finished blowing the shofar. And lo and behold, they heard another shofar off in the distance somewhere. And they never did find out who was blowing that other shofar, but it gave Ken an idea. And he decided to, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could have shofars across the country or around the world? So when one shofar blew, somebody could hear it, and then they would blow their shofar and somebody else could hear it. Well, that's a little impractical yet at this time in our walk, I guess. But anyway, they initiated what they called shofars around the world. And they asked everybody in the Eastern time zone to blow their shofars for 8 minutes straight without at 10 o'clock, 10 p.m. on Yom Teruah Eve, 9 in Central, 8 in Mountain, and 7 in Pacific time. So we'd all be blowing at the same time, which means we couldn't hear each other anyway. But anyway, it's become our practice at the Green Bay area to gather at a pond on some people's property. It's a kind of a nice time to get people together who don't normally fellowship together necessarily. And we had 50, 60 people come. And this year, somebody brought a large tent to put up so we could go inside if we needed to. Well, it was threatening rain. It was clouding up, and we got there. Of course, we welcomed Shabbat, so we were there before sundown, and then we kind of schmoozed and that sort of thing. And so it's getting on towards 9 o'clock, and it's really clouding up, and it's starting to lightning and sprinkle a little bit, and the woman whose parents allow us to use their land texted her and said, according to radar, there was a big storm. It's coming right at us, 60-mile-an-hour winds and heavy rain, and maybe we ought to call it off. So some people got their iPhones out, and they're looking at the radar, and sure enough, this big storm, it's all the way from Green Bay, extends down south past Appleton, if you know Wisconsin geography at all, and it looks like it's going to be heavy. And so anyway, Brian, our friend who helps with Hebrew Roots, was kind of leading this whole thing because it was his father-in-law's and mother-in-law's property we were on. And so he led a corporate prayer. Well, some of the people, especially those with small children, decided a better part of wisdom to leave. So some of the people left, but the rest of us hung out. And it would just get really dark and this lightning flashing, not from the clouds to earth, but from cloud to cloud. It was quite spectacular, quite a light show. And then it would start to break. And then it would cloud up again. And this is the way it was. And we got to 9 o'clock, and all we've had was a few sprinkles and a little bit of wind. And so we went ahead and did our blowing, and then we had to clean the place up and tear down the tent and all of that. And so on. We never did get the storm. Well, apparently what happened was that this storm would start to develop and then it would break up by us. It rained really heavy south of us, but we had a wonderful light show and we were able to celebrate and blow the shofars for 8 minutes like we've done for the last several years. Our God is an awesome God. Okay, I do have one story left. Surprise, surprise. And it really, for once, has something to do with my talk. These two fellas, they were believers, they were Christians, and they had met at young, in their 20s, and they had met at church, and they just really became fast friends, and they decided to room together, and they started to room together. Well, one of them was a black man, and one was a white man, and they had this constant discussion going: is God black or is he white? And they just, every time they got together, this is all they could talk about. And they actually ended up working at the same place, so they're commuting together. And so they're on their way to work one day, and they got into this intense discussion, and the driver wasn't watching. He ran a red light. They had a terrible accident. They both got killed. And of course, they went up to the pearly gates, and St. Peter's there, and he checks them in on his Macintosh and says, "Yeah, you're supposed to be here." And so they said, "Well, before we come in, we have one question we've been struggling with for years. Is God black or is he white?" And St. Peter said, "Well, I could answer your question, but if you watch those double doors over there in a few minutes, you'll find out." So they waited. Pretty soon the doors opened, and God walks out and says, "Buenos dias, señores." So now you have it. But that's kind of what my talk is about today. I guess you might say this is a politically incorrect talk. It's called Abraham's Math. And over the past couple of decades now, there's been a great increase in interest in the so-called lost tribes of Israel. People are questioning where their descendants of these people might be today. There are many theories out there, none of which can be proved. I emphasize none of which can be proved beyond a shadow of a doubt. But I'd like to begin examining a couple of scriptures, first of all, that involve the lost tribes, the so-called lost tribes. For those of you who aren't familiar with it, after the death of Solomon, the kingdom was divided in two. 10 tribes in the north were called the House of Israel, and 2 tribes in the south were called the House of Judah. The 13th tribe, because Joseph had 2 tribes, Ephraim and Manasseh. No, I'll tell you when I'm ready for that. We have a handout later. The tribe of Levi, most of the tribe of Levi went to the south because that's where the temple was. So anyway, there's the lost tribes are, I should turn this on too, go under a number of different names in Scripture. The House of Israel is probably the most common. They're also sometimes referred to as the Northern Kingdom. Ephraim is the key, the chief tribe, like Judah was the chief tribe in the south. So sometimes they go, they're called Ephraim. Samaria is the capital of the northern 10 tribes, so that's used. And then Joseph is sometimes referred to in this context of meaning the lost tribes. So the essence of the story is found in 2 Kings chapter 17. We'll just look at that briefly. 2 Kings 17, beginning in verse 3, Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, came up against him, and Hosea, the king of Israel, the house of Israel, became his vassal and paid him tribute money. And the king of Assyria uncovered a conspiracy by Hosea. They had the conspiracies back in those days, too. For he had sent messengers to So, king of Egypt, and brought no tribute to the king of Assyria as he had done year by year. Therefore, the king of Assyria shut him up and bound him in prison. Now the king of Assyria went throughout all the land and went up to Samaria and besieged it. Samaria is the capital, remember. He besieged it for 3 years. In the 9th year of Hosea, the king of Assyria took Samaria and carried Israel away to Assyria and placed them in Halah and beyond the Habor and the river of Gozan and the cities of the Medes. We're not going to go into the geography of all of that on this time. You can get a good Bible atlas. You can see where they were taken. So this was really the final installment of the captivity that had been going on for some time. Other portions of the house of Israel had been taken captive prior to that. Unlike the kingdom of Judah, which was also taken captive, but not until 136 years later in 586 BCE, by Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, and they were able to return to the land some 70 years later, as you know, and rebuild the temple and all of that. The house of Israel, however, never returned to the land. They became lost to the annals of history, for God had given them a written bill of divorcement and sent them away. Jeremiah chapter 3, verse 6. The Lord said also to me in the days of Josiah the king, have you seen what backsliding Israel has done? She's gone up on every high mountain and under every green tree, and there played the harlot. And I said after she had done all these things, return to me. But she did not return, and her treacherous sister Judah saw it. Then I saw for all the causes for which backsliding Israel had committed adultery, I put her away and gave her a certificate of divorce. Yet her treacherous sister Judah did not fear, but went and played the harlot also. So it came to pass, through her casual harlotry, that she defiled the land and committed adultery with stones and trees. So the house of Israel was dispersed, taken captive and dispersed. And as the kingdoms in that region began to change, Babylon, the Babylonians overran the Assyrians, and some of the peoples moved on to other areas. They were taken, we understand, Assyria would take the people group as a whole, their families and everything, and they'd just resettle them in an area, so they still had all their family structure that helped to keep the rebellions down. And over the years, historians have tried to determine where the lost tribes went. A number of theories have been put forth over the centuries, and here's just a partial list of some of the claims that have been made for certain peoples that they're part of the lost tribes. The Chingmin of Tibet, the Khazars, who were in Eastern Europe, the Karaites even, some say, were really lost tribe people. The Samaritans, there's still a remnant of Samaritans that live in Israel. They were the people that were brought in to replace the Israelites, but there were no doubt Israelites who were left in the land, who didn't get taken captive, who intermarried, so it's kind of a mixture. They were there, of course, in the time of Yeshua, looked down upon by the Jews. The Berbers of North Africa, the Shinde tribe of Japan, and various Native American Indian groups, especially the Cherokees, have some astounding traditions that seem to point even to the festival of Sukkot. And so these are some of the theories that have been put forth by historians who have looked at the lost tribe story. One small group of people a number of years ago was recognized as being a remnant of one of the lost tribes. That's the Shinlung tribe, which resides in northeast corner of India. They've been recognized as descendants of the tribe of Manasseh. They have been given the right of return to Israel, providing they go through a conversion process, learning the customs and traditions of rabbinic Judaism. But because God divorced and dispersed the house of Israel, they have become lost, by and large, among the Gentile nations. Lost not just to history, but to themselves. Lost their identity. And God gave this warning to the house of Israel, what he intended to do to them. It's in the book of Hosea. Hosea chapter 1. Beginning in verse 2. Then the Lord began to speak by Hosea, the Lord said to Hosea, go take yourself a wife of harlotry and children of harlotry, for the land has committed great harlotry by departing from the Lord. So he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. And the Lord said to him, call his name Jezreel. Jezreel means he sows, like sowing seed. For in a little while I will avenge the bloodshed of Jezreel on the house of Jehu, and bring an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. It shall come to pass in that day that I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. And she conceived again and bore a daughter. Then God said to him, call her name Lo-Ruhamah, for I will no longer have mercy on the house of Israel, but I will utterly take them away. Yet I will have mercy on the house of Judah, will save them by the Lord their God, and will not save them by bow, nor by sword or battle, or by horses or horsemen. Now when she had weaned Lo-Ruhamah, she conceived and bore a son, and God said, call his name Lo-Ami, for you are not my people, and I will not be your God. Pretty severe. So God told the house of Israel he was going to scatter them among the nations, to sow them like seed among the other peoples of the world. He was not going to have any mercy to them, and they were no longer going to be considered God's people. Now, despite this dire prophecy, God also said they were going to become extremely numerous. And when that day came, God was going to regather them, join them to the house of Judah, and bring them back into the land. Going on to verse 10 in Hosea 1, yet the number of the children of Israel shall be as the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured or numbered. And it shall come to pass in the place where it was said to them, you are not my people. There it shall be said to them, you are the sons of the living God. Then the children of Judah and the children of Israel shall be gathered together. So we see this two parts, the house of Judah, the house of Israel. They'll be gathered together and appoint for themselves one head, and they shall come up out of the land, for great will be the day of him sowing, of Jezreel. And so the house of Israel was scattered among the nations of the earth, and in that scattering they lost their identity. Now, Judah was also dispersed, although they were taken captive in 586 B.C. by the Babylonians. They did not lose their identity. Many of them were actually left in the land. We understand it was basically the upper class, the nobles, the kings, the priests that were taken captive, and many of the common people remained in the land and were still there when Ezra and Nehemiah and others returned to rebuild the temple. But then in 70 Common Era, this second temple was destroyed and the Jews were again dispersed, this time throughout the entire world. Although many Jews did assimilate, and most of them never lost their identity, even to this day. But we find, especially in the Messianic movement, people who begin to tracing their family lineage, and they find out they have a Jewish ancestor or two or three or whatever. So today the Jews, the house of Judah, can be found in every nation on earth. And for this reason, we find today Jews called Falashes that come from Ethiopia. They're black-skinned. Jews of Asia, who are of Asian appearance. The Ashkenazi Jews of Europe look Caucasian. The Sephardic Jews of the Middle East look more Middle Eastern. There are many Jews who carry Spanish names. It is said that many of the Spanish names which end in E-Z are of Jewish origin. However, we have to be careful we don't take that as an absolute. In this study of lost tribes, you can't take a lot of things as absolutes. Interesting ideas, interesting theories. But be careful when you get too dogmatic about something. You may find yourself eating a little crow, and crow is an unclean bird. So, Now, a theory gained considerable support in the 19th and early 20th centuries. It's called British Israelism. It's got a bad name today. In this teaching, the majority of the Lost Ten Tribes were said to have migrated as a body into northwestern Europe, where they became the physical ancestors of modern nations found there and ultimately of America. Primarily, they teach that the Caucasian peoples of the British Isles and the United States respectively constitute the lost tribes of Ephraim, and Manasseh. The first British Israel teacher was an Englishman named Richard Brothers. He lived from 1757 to 1824. He believed that God had given him a divine mission to lead the Jews back to Palestine, and that he was a direct descendant of the house of King David. The actual British Israel movement began with a teacher named John Wilson, who died in 1871. We're not sure of his birth date. Wilson attempted to demonstrate that the lost tribes had migrated from the Middle East to Europe. One of the ways he did this was by finding words in different languages which sounded the same, such as British. He said that means Brit Ish, which means covenant man. Now, the problem with that is, in Hebrew, it would be Ish Brit, I understand, the proper grammar. And so it got turned around somehow. Another one was Saxon. He said that meant Isaac's sons. In Denmark was Dan's Mark, the tribe of Dan. Jutland, which is a peninsula of Denmark, was called, as he said, derived from Jew's land. So all of these things, again, you have to be very careful. You can't be dogmatic about any of that. Interesting ideas. In 1870, a Congregational Church paster named Joseph Wild began to teach British Israel theory in the United States. Numerous other men picked up the teaching. One of the most notable was a man named J.H. Allen, who wrote a book called Judah's Scepter, Joseph's Birthright. Allen had a direct influence on Herbert Armstrong, who was a major British Israel teacher in the 20th century. In classic British Israel teaching, it was taught that the Jews, the house of Judah, were the brothers of the lost tribes of the house of Israel. However, today, some have perverted the original British Israel teaching by claiming that the Jews are not really the Jews, and that they are the only racially pure Israelites are those Caucasians who are said to be the descendants of the house of Israel. These anti-Semitic teachers from various radical right-wing religious groups claim that the modern-day Jews are imposters and that the real descendants of the house of Judah all became followers of Yeshua in the first century, and that today's Jews are really Edomites, descendants of Esau, or they are from other, quote-unquote, mongrel races. One of the first men to pervert the British Israel teaching was Reuben Sawyer. He was an Oregon clergyman who was involved with the Ku Klux Klan in the early 1920s. In Sawyer's view, the mixed-race line of the lost tribes somehow became the pure bloodline, while the much more racially pure line of the Jews became impure. The worst anti-Semitic teaching which exists today, I believe, is what's called a Satan seed doctrine. In this evil teaching, both Jews and blacks are said to be descendants of Cain, who they claim was fathered by Hasatan, Satan the devil, not by Adam. There's an easy way to prove from Scripture that Adam, not Hasatan, was the father of Cain. All you have to do is go to Genesis 4, verse 1. Now Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain, and said, I have acquired a man from the Lord. Pretty clear. I remember a man sat in our house one time, and he's going through all of this Satan seed stuff, and finally I broke in a little bit, and I said, well, let's go look at the Scripture. He turned to this chapter, and he read it. He said, I may have to rethink all of this. Good. I think maybe you should. The idea that the Jews who rejected Yeshua were descended from Esau is also easily refuted. John 1:11 says, He came to his own, and his own did not receive them. Now, logically, if he was the ones that rejected him were Edomites, then that means he must have been an Edomite. But we know from Scripture he was from Judah. Hebrews 7:14, for it is evident that our Lord rose from Judah, of which tribe Moses spoke nothing concerning priesthood. Yeshua was a Jew from the tribe of Judah. Those who were his own who rejected him were also Jews from the tribe of Judah, or from the house of Judah. Of course, on the other hand, thousands of Jews did accept Yeshua as the Messiah. We read about it in Acts 21, verse 20. And when they heard it, they glorified the Lord, and they said to him, "You see, brother, how many myriads of Jews there are who have believed, and they're all zealous for the law." So thus today, the original British Israel teaching often, I believe, takes a bum rap because of those who have perverted the original teaching into racist anti-Semitism in its worst forms. Some also denigrate the teachings of J.H. Allen and Herbert Armstrong. However, I believe we should honor their teaching, not because they were fully correct, for they were not, and neither am I, but because it was a stepping stone to what we understand today. So a new approach began to develop about, I guess, 15, 20 years ago, that the Lost Tribes teaching are not, and they're being expounded by teachers. A couple of famous ones, well-known ones, were Batya Wooten, who is part of one of the leaders of NMIA, Messianic Israel Alliance, she and her husband Angus, and also Eddie Chumney, who wrote a book called Restoring the Two Houses of Israel. Wooten wrote a book called Who is Israel and Why You Need to Know. There's other books out by this time on the market, and some good, some not so good, like all books. In these works, the authors put forth the proposition that the physical descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Yaakov may be far more widespread among the peoples of the world than just those of Anglo-Saxon stock, which the former British Israel theory was touting. In fact, the physical seed of Abraham may, by this time, have become nearly universal. The basis for this idea lies in how one interprets a key word in the passage found in Genesis 12, verses 1 through 3. Let's read it. Now the Lord said to Abram, "Get out of your country, from your family, from your father's house, to a land I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great. You shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. I will curse him who curses you. And in you all families of the earth shall be blessed." And that verse is used time and again in the Messianic movement to indicate that we should be blessing Israel. Especially important is this phrase, "And in you all families of the earth shall be blessed." Now, Eddie Chumney, who I think some of you probably know, interpreted this crucial verse. In Hebrew, it reads, "Vi nivruku beka kol mishpachot ha'adma." The key word here is nivruku. The Hebrew word, and I'm quoting Chumney now, the Hebrew word nivruku is translated in most English texts as "be blessed." However, the usual Hebrew word for "be blessed" is not nivruku, but yivruku, with a Y instead of an N at the beginning. The word nivruku is in the Nephal conjugation of the Hebrew word barak. The Hebrew word barak has a deeper meaning than just blessed. In five places, I'm still quoting here, in the Talmud and other rabbinic literature, nivruku is translated as "grafted" or "intermingled." In the Orthodox Jewish Art Scroll Tanakh series, volume 1, it says, quote, "There is an opinion shared by Rashbam and others that the verb v'nivruku in Genesis 12:3 is related to the root barak, as in the Mishnaic term mavrik, meaning to intermingle or graft." This interpretation is inspired by the fact that nowhere else besides here do we find barak in the sense of blessing in the Nephal conjugation, while in the sense of grafting, it is common in that form. End of quote. So what all this means is that the verse in question could be translated as follows: "And in you shall all families of the earth be grafted or intermingled." The only physical way all families of the earth could be grafted or intermingled is if the physical seed of Abraham were assimilated into every family, emphasis every family, on the face of the earth. So the question, does this Nivruku theory fly, or does it crash and burn? Does this interpretation of and translation of Genesis 12:3 stand up when it's tested against other scriptures? Now, Shaul, the Apostle Paul, taught that all believers in Yeshua are of the seed of Abraham in Galatians 3, verse 26, "For you are all sons of God through faith in Messiah Yeshua, for as many of you as were baptized into Messiah have put on Messiah. There is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither slave nor free, there is neither male nor female, for you are all one in Messiah Yeshua. And if you are Messiahs, then you are Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise." This passage is understood by most to mean that when one is immersed into Messiah Yeshua, they become Abraham's seed spiritually. However, it might also be understood to mean that the very fact that a Gentile becomes a believer in Messiah Yeshua proves that he is already of the physical seed and physical descent of Abraham. That's kind of an outlandish statement. That's my statement, so you can take me to task for it. The assumption behind the Nivruku theory is that all or nearly all people who are believers in Yeshua HaMashiach are very likely not only the spiritual descendants of Abraham based on Galatians, but his physical descendants as well. I'm talking about you guys, okay? This issue is no doubt, as you can imagine, it turned into a great debate in the Messianic movement, because Messianic Judaism claims that all Israel is contained within modern-day Judaism. Okay, you can pass out the handout now. Susan's got some handouts here. I thought it was better if you had a handout rather than trying to put this on the screen, because it's a little bit complex. In May 2002, what triggered this whole article, this whole talk, the Atlantic Monthly magazine published an article on genealogy. The writer's name was Steve Olson. He was not a genealogist himself, but had done some family research and was quite familiar with procedures involved in tracing one's family tree. Just out of curiosity, how many of you here have tried tracing your family tree in the past? Okay, only a few. It's an interesting study, and I was telling Derek yesterday, it's one you don't want to get into if you don't want to admit there's black sheep in your family, because you're going to find things you don't want to know sooner or later on some ancestor of yours that wasn't quite so goody-goody as you might have thought. Anybody else need a handout? Great, thank you. Well, anyway, Steve Olson, during a visit to Ireland, one of the countries of his ancestry, Olson met a computer scientist and genealogist at Dublin City University named Mark Humphreys. One of the discoveries Humphreys made in his research was, and I'm quoting again now from this article, "Whenever a reliable family tree was available, almost anyone of European ancestry turned out to be descended from English royalty." How many of you have European ancestry? Pretty universal. Some of you may have it that don't think you have it. We'll get to that. Even such unlikely people as Hermann Göring and Daniel Boone, Humphreys began to think that such descent was the rule rather than the exception in the Western world, even if relatively few people had the documents to demonstrate it. It's interesting to note that if one is descended from English royalty, they might also be descended from King David, because that's another claim that's made. For the royal family has genealogical charts claiming ancestry way back to King David. It's an interesting study. I have those charts at home. I should have brought them. I forgot a lot of things. According to Eliezer Shulman in his book, The Sequence of Events in the Old Testament, Abraham was born in the year 1948 from creation. That's approximately 2056 BCE. If you turn your sheet over on the back here, where it says Abraham was said to be born in 1948 from creation. Bishop James Usher calculated creation as occurring in 404 BCE, and of course that's greatly disputed. If that were so, then it would place the birth of Abraham in 2056. That means that over 4,070 years have passed since the birth of Abraham. If we use 25 years for each generation, it means that we are almost 163 generations removed from Abraham. If we use 40 years for each generation, we're about 102 generations removed from Abraham. And if we use 100 years for each generation, we are nearly 41 generations removed from Abraham. You can see generation lengths on the back. I'll give you some corrected dates based on today. This was done a few years ago. If it's 25 years in length, take us back to the 41st generation would be in 992 Common Era. It's not that long ago. It may seem like it, especially if you're young, but if a generation is 40 years in length, it would take 1,640 years to get back to the 41st generation. That would be 377, still in the Common Era after the time of Yeshua. But if we use 100 years as a generational length, it would go back 4,100 years, and that would be in 2082 BCE. Before we go on, I want to just do a little something here. I washed my hand this morning. Would somebody come and shake it? Okay. Shake the hand that shook the hand that shook the hand that shook the hand of Abraham Lincoln. Okay? Now, you are only, there's only one, two, three, four people between you and Abraham Lincoln. That seems incredible. When my father was a young lad, you can sit down, thank you. When he was a young lad, he said there was an elderly man in his town that used to say, "Shake the hand that shook the hand of Abraham Lincoln." So my dad shook his hand, I shook my dad's hand, and you shook my hand. So there's me, my father, and this man between you and Abraham Lincoln. It gives us a different concept of time. Should I do the other one, Susan? Okay, another hand. Shake the hand that shook the hand that spanked George Clooney. When I was on campaign tour years ago, 1970, we were doing a campaign in Cincinnati. And the man who organized the Ambassador College Band had been a disc jockey in Cincinnati, and he knew the Clooneys, Nick Clooney and his sister Rosemary. Some of you older people remember Rosemary Clooney, a singer. Nick Clooney is the father of George Clooney, and George at that time was probably just a little shaver running around. I didn't meet him. But anyway, I got to shake George Clooney's hand. We were on his noontime TV show in Cincinnati, and I got to shake his hand. And I figured he no doubt had spanked George at least once in his life. But anyway, Okay, back on topic. Now, if you turn your sheet over to the front page, I did a little thing here to show you how our ancestors grow geometrically. Not that you didn't know this, but just to see it graphically is quite astounding. You're one person, you have two parents, four grandparents, eight great-grandparents, 16 great-greats, and so on. You get back only nine generations, and there's 256 great-great-great-great, however many greats it is, grandparents. 256. And then below, I listed that out, how fast it grows. There's an old story. If you were offered a penny, $1 million today, or a penny that doubled every day for 30 days, which one would you take? And if you were wise, you would take the penny, because you'd end up with much more than $1 million. So anyway, that's the way our genealogy works. If you go back 41 generations, that's on the other side of the sheet, the 41st generation, if every one of your ancestors was an individual person, you would have 1,099,511,627,776 individual ancestors. It don't compute, folks, because we only have at this time somewhere over 7 billion people on Earth, probably the largest population the Earth has ever supported, the largest human population. Although that's, of course, also debatable. So it doesn't take long to get back generationally to the point where there would be more people in your family tree than there were people on Earth. So what does that mean? You got duplicates. You got multitude of duplicates. I can remember when I was doing some research years ago, got back into New England and colonial times, and this couple appeared two different places. Edmund Rice and his wife were here, and they had a descendant that married into my line, and here they were found down here in the next generation with a different descendant that married into my line, people that married that were distant cousins and didn't know it. And so we know the average length of a generation is certainly open to debate. That's why I gave you three examples here. I wasn't quite sure. 25 years seems, or 30 years would seem more logical for us today, but scripturally we can find support for 40 years and 100 years and probably some other numbers as well. So getting back to Steve Olson in this Atlantic Monthly article, he says, and I quote, "The idea that virtually anyone with a European ancestor descends from English royalty seems bizarre, but it accords perfectly with some recent research, recent at that time, done by Joseph Chang, a statistician at Yale. In 1999 paper titled Recent Common Ancestors of All Present-Day Individuals, Chang showed how to reconcile the potentially huge number of our ancestors with the quantities of people who actually lived in the past. Under the conditions laid out in his paper, the most recent common ancestor of every European today, except for recent immigrants to the continent, was someone who lived in Europe in the surprisingly recent past only about 600 years ago. Did you get that? 600 years ago. Could be a common ancestor to all of us in this room. In other words, all Europeans alive today have among their ancestors the same man or woman who lived around 1400 common era. However, the mathematical model developed by Chang contains one assumption that can change this seemingly incredible fact. It assumes that every person in Europe over this 600-year period could potentially marry any other person of the opposite sex in Europe. According to Olson, these departures from randomness must push back somewhat the date of Europeans' most recent common ancestor. However, there has been a great churning of people the world over the last several hundred years as European civilization spread around the world during the Age of Discovery. Olson continues, quote, "This constant churning of people makes it possible to apply Chang's analysis to the world as a whole. For example, almost everyone in the New World must be descended from English royalty. Even people of predominantly African or Native American ancestry because of the long history of intermarriage in the Americas. Olson believes the most common ancestor of all, at that time 6 billion people on Earth, lived probably just a couple thousand years ago. That's during the time of Yeshua. I have a little article here I want to read to you. It's out of a magazine called The Week. And it's in a section called Best Columns, the U.S. And it's called The Truth About Race is Gray. It's written by a man named Brent Staples, published in the New York Times. And he says, people sometimes ask me how a black man came to such a white name, as Brent said, Brent Staples in the New York Times. Staples is in fact an English name, which my family apparently inherited from the transplanted Britons who owned our ancestors in Virginia. I recently took a DNA test offered by a company that tracks people's racial and ethnic origins, and it turns out that slave owners had given us more than a preference for British names. They also gave us their DNA. While half my genes originated in Africa, a quarter came from Europe. To my surprise, a fifth came from Asia. This is actually a common result among people who take these ancestry tests. People who consider themselves black turn out to have white, Native American, and other ancestors mixed in, and many white people discover to their surprise that there are African Americans mixed into their family histories. These DNA tests are finally proving what anthropologists have long argued. Race in this country is a social contract, not a true genetic category. That's because in America's tortured racial past, there was a great deal of furtive race mixing. In every generation going back to the emancipation, thousands of light-skinned people of mixed race have chosen to pass themselves off as white. They intermarried with unsuspecting Europeans, mixing their genes with those of Italians, Irish, and other Caucasians. Blacks, too, intermarried with Native Americans, Asians, and Europeans, so that few people now identified as black have wholly African genes. The ultimate point is that none of us really knows who we are, ancestrally speaking. We only know that our ancestors chose what our ancestors chose to tell us. I have a theory, which I'll just throw in here. There was a city called Carthage on the North African coast, which was a Phoenician city. The Phoenicians were the seagoing people, but also there were tribes, Dan and Naphtali and Zebulun, who also were seafaring tribes. And Paleo-Hebrew and the Phoenician language are almost identical. I believe that at Carthage there were a lot of Israelites, if you will, from the northern tribes. And when Rome finally sacked Carthage, and those people who could fled, they couldn't get out by sea. Many of them went across a much smaller Sahara Desert down into West Africa. And guess where America's slaves came from? West Africa, primarily. Ghana, that area. I believe that many of those slaves that were kept in those holds of those ships were already carrying Israelite blood when they landed on the shores. And that's my belief. And I can't prove it, but someday we'll know one way or another. Anyway, if this theory is anywhere near correct, since Abraham lived about 4,000 years ago, it's no great stretch to conclude that every person on earth today carries the physical seed of Abraham within his gene pool, just as the Nivruku theory suggests. Likewise, since God scattered the house of Israel, it is easily possible that every person on earth today is also descended from Yaakov's 12 sons, the children of Israel. We not only share the Ruach HaKodesh, the Holy Spirit, we also share, I believe, the physical seed of Abraham. This concept adds a whole new dimension to the idea of being grafted into Israel. So let's go to Romans chapter 11, the grafted in chapter, starting in verse 11. I say then, have they stumbled that they should fall? Certainly not. But through their fall, to provoke them to jealousy, salvation has come to the Gentiles. Now if their fall is riches for the world, and their failure riches for the Gentiles, how much more their fullness? For I speak to you Gentiles, inasmuch as I am an apostle to the Gentiles, I magnify my ministry. If by any means I may provoke you to jealousy, those who are my flesh, and save some of them. For if their being cast away is the reconciling of the world, what will their acceptance be but life from the dead? For if the first fruit is holy, the lump is also holy, and if the root is holy, so are the branches. If you have a root in Abraham, that's a holy root. So the casting away of Israel was only a temporary phenomenon, so that the world as a whole can eventually be reconciled. Is it possible this refers to the casting away of the house of Israel through a written bill of divorcement, as we saw in Jeremiah 3? I submit that God cast away the house of Israel in order to spread the physical seed of Abraham around the world. And now, through Yeshua, he is calling a remnant of those castaway Israelites who think they are Gentiles back into the commonwealth of Israel. Isaiah likened the children of Israel to a vineyard that was planted with much hope and promise, but which failed to produce good fruit. Isaiah chapter 5, verse 1. Now let me sing to my well-beloved a song of my beloved regarding his vineyard. My well-beloved has a vineyard on a very fruitful hill. He dug it up and cleared out its stones and planted it with the choicest vine. He built a tower in its midst and also made a winepress in it. So he expected it to bring forth good grapes, but it brought forth wild grapes. And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge, please, between me and my vineyard. What more could have been done to my vineyard that I have not done in it? Why then, when I expected it to bring forth good grapes, did it bring forth wild grapes? And now, please, let me tell you what I will do to my vineyard. I will take away its hedge, and it shall be burned, and break down its wall, and it shall be trampled down. I will lay it waste. It shall not be pruned or dug. But there shall come up briars and thorns. I also command the clouds that they rain no rain on it. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel. The men of Judah are his pleasant plant. He looked for justice, and behold, oppression. For righteousness, but behold, a cry for help. Both the house of Israel and the house of Judah failed to live up to the expectations and hopes which were invested in them when God called them forth out of Egypt. They brought forth wild grapes instead of good fruit. Therefore, God sent both houses into captivity, but Judah was allowed to return so the promised Messiah could be brought forth. Isaiah 5 down in verse 13, therefore my people have gone into captivity because they have no knowledge. Their honorable men are famished and their multitude dried up with thirst. Physical thirst, yes, but more importantly, they had centuries of spiritual thirst. The house of Judah was returned to the promised land 70 years after the Babylonian captivity, and then dispersed again, and in 1948, the house of Judah was again given sovereignty over a portion of the promised land. However, the house of Israel has yet to return. Down in verse 26 of Isaiah 5, he will lift up a banner to the nations from afar and will whistle to them from the end of the earth. Surely they will come with speed, swiftly. Do you hear it? Do you hear God whistling for you? He's calling you. He's calling you home. The banner, the Nasi, that will be lifted up to the nations when God whistles for Israel is none other than the Messiah. Chapter 11, verse 10, and in that day there shall be a root of Jesse who shall stand as a banner to the people. For the Gentiles shall seek him, and his resting place shall be glorious. It shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall set his hand again the second time to recover the remnant of his people who are left from Assyria and Egypt, from Patros and Cush, from Elam and Shinar, from Hamat and the islands of the sea. He will set up a banner for the nations and will assemble the outcasts of Israel and gather together the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth, all over the earth. Not just Europe and America, but South America, Africa, Asia, Australia, the islands of the South Pacific, wherever people are found. I think we can better understand Romans 11 now when Paul speaks about the Gentiles who are grafted grafted into the olive tree of Israel. Many of those Gentiles may well be actual descendants of the house of Israel, along with the house of Judah, who have been cut off and scattered. Back to Romans 11, verse 15, for if they're being cast away, that is the Jews, is the reconciling of the world, what will their acceptance be but life from the dead? For if the first fruit is holy, the lump is also holy, and the root is holy, and so are the branches. And if some of the branches were broken off, and you being a wild olive tree, remember back in Isaiah when he said they became wild, a wild vineyard, a wild olive tree were grafted in among them, and with them became a partaker of the root and fatness of the olive tree. Do not boast against the branches, but if you do boast, remember that you do not support the root, but the root supports you. If we are attached to God through Yeshua, the banner grafted back into the chosen people of God, the children of Israel, today, the descendants of the house of Israel and even some of the descendants of the house of Judah do not know they are of the physical seed of Abraham. They believe themselves to be full-blooded Gentiles. The full restoration will occur when God removes all of the sins of his people, Israel. Verse 25, Romans 11, for I do not desire, brethren, that you should be ignorant of this mystery, lest you should be wise in your own opinion, that blindness in part has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in. And so all Israel will be saved. That's an astounding statement. What do we mean by all? As it is written, a deliverer will come out of Zion, and he will turn away ungodliness from Jacob. For this is my covenant with them when I take away their sins. Concerning the gospel, they, the Jews, are enemies for your sake, but concerning the election, they are beloved for the sake of the fathers, for the gifts and the calling of God are irrevocable. And so all Israel will be saved. It's an astounding idea that if all Israel be saved and everybody has the seed of Abraham within them, are we not all potentially part of Israel? I don't know if you're aware of it or not, but when Paul writes his letter to the Galatians, he speaks to them as Gentiles. And yet in the area of Galatia, the people that settled there were people that had migrated into Europe and then back into what today is Turkey. They were Celtic people. They were people related to the Irish and some of the French and the Welsh and some of the Scots. Same people. They're back in Galatia, but Paul's calling them Gentiles. But is it not possible that they were descendants from the tribes? Just a thought. I don't want to be too dogmatic on all of this. Maybe I am, but I just want to throw a lot of this stuff out and let you churn it around. The book of Hosea is a prophecy that is addressed specifically to the house of Israel. We've already seen that. Previously, we read chapter 1, how God was going to sow to Jezreel, the house of Israel, throughout the nations of the world. He promised to have no mercy, lo ru maha, on them. And he said they would not be his people, lo ami. These prophecies began to be fulfilled in 722 BCE and a little before that, when the northern 10 tribes were taken captive and removed from the land. These prophecies have continued to be fulfilled down through the countries, centuries, and right up into our time. For today, the house of Israel is still scattered throughout the world, and the house of Israel still does not know they are literal descendants of Abraham. Today, the vast majority of the house of Israel still believes they are Gentile. But God has also promised to bring the house of Israel back to the land to be rejoined with the house of Judah. We read about that in Hosea chapter 2, verse 14. Therefore, beloved, I will allure her and bring her into the wilderness and speak comfort to her, and will give her vineyards from there in the valley of Achor. As a door of hope, she shall sing there in the days of her youth, as in the days when she came up from the land of Egypt. And it shall be in that day, says the Lord, that you will call me my husband, and no longer call me my master. For I will take from her mouth the names of the Baals, and they shall be remembered by their name no more. In that day I will make a covenant for them with the beasts of the field and the birds of the air, with the creeping things of the ground. Bow and sword of battle I will shatter from the earth to make them lie down safely. I will betroth you to me forever. Yes, I will betroth you to me in righteousness and justice, in loving kindness and mercy. I will betroth you to me in faithfulness, and you shall know the Lord. It shall come to pass in that day that I will answer, says the Lord. I will answer the heavens, and they shall hear the answer the earth. The earth shall answer with grain, with new wine, with oil. They shall answer Jezreel. Then I will sow her for myself in the earth, and I will have mercy, Ruhamah, on her who had not obtained mercy. And I will say to those who were not my people, Lo Ami, you are my people, my Ami. They shall say, you are my God. The northern 10 tribes of the house of Israel were taken captive and never returned to the land as a recognizable body of people. However, a small remnant are undoubtedly mixed in with today's Jewish population. The vast majority of the house of Israel have spread around the world. In some cases, they remained together and became known by other names, such as the Shinlun of India, the Lemba of Africa. Now, that's an interesting story in itself, the Lemba tribe, who carry the DNA of the Kohanim. And we can talk about that later if you want. The Anglo-Saxon people of Britain, along with the Celts of Ireland, Wales, Scotland, and France, many remained in the vast stretches of Asia, while others migrated into Africa and Europe. Eventually, the descendants of the house of Israel made their way to the New World and even the islands of the South Pacific. Through intermarriage, the skin color and facial features of those original Israelites have taken on the form of the indigenous people with whom they intermarried, so that today Israelites can be found among all peoples and racial groups of the world. The veracity of this claim can now be substantiated through genealogical and statistical research. The claim that all people on the face of the earth today are quite likely descended from a single individual who lived only 2,000 years ago makes it even more feasible that everyone could very well be descended from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Isaiah 51, verse 1, "Listen to me, you who follow after righteousness, who seek the Lord. Look to the rock from which you were hewn, and to the hole of the pit from which you were dug. Look to Abraham your father, and to Sarah who bore you. For I called him alone, and blessed him, and increased him. You are my brothers and sisters, you are my cousins in the flesh. We're all one family. Let's start acting like it." So what does it mean to be a physical descendant of the great patriarchs and matriarchs? Well, it doesn't mean a thing unless one has dedicated their life to serving the eternal God in all of all creation, the one who is the giver of life. There is no advantage to tracing one's genealogy, trying to prove ancestry from the patriarchs. It can be an interesting exercise, but Paul said in 1 Timothy 1, verse 3, as I urged you when I went to Macedonia, remain in Ephesus that you may charge some that they teach no other doctrine, nor give heed to fables and endless genealogies, which cause disputes rather than godly edification, which is in faith. From a human standpoint, it is interesting to find out if one is Jewish or a Levite or a Cohen, but it's not really important and can sometimes lead to pride and jealousy. Titus 3:9, but avoid foolish disputes, genealogies, contentions, and strivings about the law. Oh my, we don't do that, do we? For they are unprofitable and useless. Whether we as individuals are physical descendants of the house of Israel, the house of Judah, or through some quirk of genealogy are full-blooded Gentiles is not what is important. The important thing is we have been grafted back into the commonwealth of Israel through the Messiah Yeshua. Ephesians chapter 2, verse 11. Therefore, remember that you, both the house of Israel and Gentiles, once considered to be Gentiles in the flesh, who are called uncircumcision by what is called the circumcision made in the flesh by hands, that at that time you were without Messiah, being aliens from the commonwealth of Israel, and strangers from the covenants of promise, having no hope and without God in the world. But now in Messiah Yeshua, you who once were far off, both the house of Israel and the Gentiles, have been brought near by the blood of Messiah. The house of Israel was divorced by God and became just like Gentiles in the flesh. Now all of us are brought together in service to God through the blood of Messiah Yeshua. Finally, then, in 1 John chapter 1, verse 5, this is the message which we have heard from him and declare to you, that God is light and in him is no darkness at all. If we say that we have fellowship with him and walk in darkness, we lie and do not practice the truth. But if we walk in the light as he is in the light, we have fellowship with one another. And the blood of Yeshua HaMashiach, his son, cleanses us from all sin. So let us walk in the light by knowing who we are and who our brothers and sisters are. Let us continue to be cleansed by the precious blood of Yeshua. Shalom.